Your Hit Parade, starring Frank Sinatra.
Who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men?
And now, smile a while with Lorenzo Jones and his wife, Belle.
Here's the Manhattan merry-go-round that brings you the bright side of life, that whirls you in music to all the big night spots of New York town, to hear the top songs of the week sung so clearly you can understand every word and sing them yourself.
This is the Golden Age of Radio. I'm Dick Bertel, and tonight we'll take you on another audio excursion back to radio's formative years. You'll hear the programs that made the era golden, and meet people who made those broadcasts a reality.
The Golden Age of Radio is brought to you by WTIC Radio and Cromwell Savings Bank. Now here is your host, Dick Bertel.
Good evening. And with me once again is radio collector historian Ed Corcoran.
Well, hi, Dick. It's nice to be here again. And we have another famous guest tonight. We have maybe a little bit different guest. We've had a lot of actors lately. Now we're going to have a playwright, an author, and a man who did a lot of adaptations of some of the better shows on radio. Dick, I'd like to meet Robert Anderson.
It's a pleasure to have you with us. One of the most renowned American playwrights, Robert Anderson, who lives in Bridgewater, Connecticut. Good to have you here, Bob.
Good to be here, Dick.
And we're going to go back to some days long before Tea and Sympathy and some of the marvelous shows that have made so much of a success in the Broadway stage. We're going back to the days of radio tonight. This is where you got your start as a writer, really, where you began to develop your craft.
It is. It's one of my favorite media, and I learned a great deal from radio writing because you have to be right up there. The casts we had were people like Gary Cooper, Humphrey Bogart, Helen Hayes, Monty Clift, and week after week after week, you'd have to get it up, Monday rehearsal, Wednesday rehearsal, Sunday rehearsal, and it was a very technical medium, and there's only 60 minutes. And I can remember many times on a Sunday, an hour before we were to go on, we find ourselves 10 minutes over. And to get down and cut 10 minutes out of a show that's already been ready to go on.
That's easy. You take out the commercials. That'll
yeah,
be
yes. No, but you find yourself, sitting there with a stopwatch. And you cut one line here or three words there. And it's very exciting.
Oh, it is. I'm sure it is. And also probably very distressing to see your work being cut out line by line at that point.
No, I think there's where you really learn to be a professional, because you learn that no part is bigger than the whole. Mm-hmm. And obviously, if you only got 60 minutes, that's all you can do. You can't say, well, give me 10 more minutes. No, it's great. I enjoy the medium, and writing under pressure is very exciting. And writing lines for those great stars to speak, to hear your lines spoken by people like Deborah Carr and Ingrid Bergman, people like that.
Bob, exciting. When did you write for radio?
Well, I came back from the war in 1946, and I was really first a playwright. I tried to be a playwright, and I was writing plays all during this period, but I couldn't sell any. So that I wrote radio and television on the side. And so I think I must have started around 48 or 49 when I first finally, and Tea and Sympathy didn't come around until 1953,
mm-hmm.
which is when I stopped writing for radio and television.
But, when it was no longer necessary.
Yes, but if they would pay well, I would be delighted to write for radio again, because it's a writer's medium par excellence.
What do you mean by that?
Well, because the word has to do almost everything. The word and sound effects have to do almost everything, whereas in television, it's very much more of a visual medium. I have a very interesting experience when I was a playwright. And I first tried to get my radio job with the Theater Guild on the air. They said, well, you're a playwright, but this is a different medium. And I had a very difficult time breaking into radio. Finally, they did let me take one on a chance. It was Robert Montgomery in the Petrified Forest. And then after I was established as a radio writer, television came in. And they said, well, you're a radio writer, and television is a different medium. And we went through all that. And then finally, when we sold Tea and Sympathy to the movies, they said, well, you're a playwright, but the movies are doing it. And finally, we got rid of that one, and I wrote the screenplay in 1970.
No place else you can be tested now, is there,
in the writing medium? No.
What shows did you write for?
Well, I wrote for principally on radio. We're talking about radio here tonight. The Theater Guild on the Air, which is a great show, and the, Ed, I keep forgetting the name of the show.
Cavalcade
of America, yes. And they were all adaptations. Cavalcade wasn't. Cavalcade were originals based on
historical events.
I remember one that I wrote and we never did was on the four chaplains. Do you remember the story? You're old enough to remember the four chaplains who went down in World War II on the ship and gave their life jackets to...
He's old enough, he may not remember it.
I remember the Sullivan brothers going down. But
this was, and then they named the destroyer the four chaplains.
Yep.
And I wrote that story, it never got on. But most of these were adaptations for the Theatre Guild. I did about 40 shows for them.
Doing the Cavalcade of America series, though, would seem to me you'd have to do a great deal of research if you were going to write about a particular historical figure.
Yes, you would have to. And I'm not basically a very good reporter. I'm not a good researcher. And most of my theater work has been very things that are very close to home. And I didn't particularly like research. So maybe that's why I didn't do too much of it. Whereas in the Theater Guild was largely adaptations of books and plays and movies that were already there.
How do you begin to adapt a book, a 300-page book, into an hour-long radio program?
Yeah, especially Dickens. You did several Dickens shows.
Yeah, David Copperfield, Oliver Twist. Mm. Well, basically, my knowledge as a playwright was helpful. You find out what the essential story is. Every play, every novel, every play has a spine, what you would call a spine, the central dramatic action, its progression from the beginning to middle to end. And you find out what that is, if you can find it. It's not always easy, because some novels don't have it. That's why novel writing is easier to write. Novels are easier to write than plays, because it doesn't require. They can wander all over the place. But a play and a radio show have to have a spine. It's basically who wants what, oddly enough. Almost every good dramatic story comes down to who wants what. What are the obstacles? What steps will they take to overcome them? So it requires several readings, first of all, to discover the spine, and then to figure out, as in David Copperfield, how you can cram it all in. But that was an extraordinary production. The David Copperfield was a Christmas show, and we had Richard Burton playing young David, and we had Cyril Richard, Basil Rathbone, Boris Karloff, you name it. We had practically every English star of the English theater at that time. It was a beautiful show. I wish that the Theater Guild would somewhere to find a way of reissuing these records. It'd be terrific to have.
Oh, they really would.
Yeah.
How did you feel as a young man? You were in your late 20s, maybe 30 years of age, writing for stars of the caliber of the ones you've just mentioned.
Yeah, it's slightly scary, and that's why I say it made a pro of you very fast, because you could practically see Helen Hayes grimace over a line, and then you didn't need to be told that something was wrong. It was a very great experience because playwrights do not really know how their plays are until they hear them aloud. I've heard so many times people say to me, can't you tell a bad play, or can't you tell that line was no good? Well, sure, if you've been at it long enough, you can. But I found at the beginning of every season, I had a lot to learn. And then by the end of the season, my dialogue would have sharpened, would have become more terse and, more dramatic. But the first show of every season, I'd sit there with a blue pencil at the first rehearsal saying, how did I ever let this run on so long? But it was a great experience. It gave me a great sense of confidence. Also, I met a very terrific woman by the name of Deborah Carr in a show I did called Remember the Day, a play by Philo Higley. And when I wrote Tea and Sympathy, I wanted Deborah in the part, and it was her greatest part. She did it.
We'll talk more with our guest in just a moment. Ed, is it possible to hear a portion of Cavalcade of America? That'll take us back a few years.
Well, I have several, but I don't have any that Bob happened to write, but can we do one anyway, just to give people an idea what the series was about?
I think that would be a good idea.
With Raymond Massey, called Wire to the West. It was about Western Union and how they got started.
Cavalcade of America. The DuPont Company, maker of better things for better living through chemistry, presents Raymond Massey in Wire to the West on Cavalcade of America. And here is Raymond Massey.
Good evening. Tonight, the DuPont Company brings Cavalcade of America back for its 15th year on the air. I've been here many times before in many roles, and on this opening night, I'm here in a new character. Hiram Sibley, a man whose work has touched the lives of every man and woman in America. And here's the story.
It's Washington, D.C., back in the middle of the last century. Mr. Hiram Sibley of Rochester, New York, enters a sleepy little telegraph office.
Anyone here? Hello? Hello?
Come in. I hear you. I ain't deep. I heard you the first time.
I want to send this telegram to Rochester.
Oh, Rochester. Got it read out?
Of course.
Rochester's pretty expensive. You'd save yourself a lot of money if you send it to New York. Even Boston would be cheaper.
Will you please send this to Rochester?
All right, if you like. I was just advising you. Let's see now. October 4, 1849. Mrs. Elizabeth Sibley. Your wife?
Yes, but why?
Just curious. Mrs. Elizabeth Sibley, business successfully concluded. Leave Washington today, arrive home Tuesday, kiss the children. Love, Hiram. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13. Kissing the children is going to cost you extra. Fees $1.75 for 10 words, 25 cents a word thereafter. Still want to kiss them?
Of course.
That'll be $2.50.
Ah, there you are. When will it arrive?
Well, I'd say it's got a pretty fair chance of arriving in Rochester early Wednesday morning.
But I'll be there myself on Tuesday.
Yeah, so you will. Well, wouldn't that be nice? Your wife won't have to bother going down to the telegraph office to get the message. You can pick it up yourself.
One 100 years ago, the infant telegraph industry teetered on the brink of chaos. Over 50 different lines, large and small, were operating along the eastern seaboard of the country, a few even reaching timidly westward towards the Mississippi. But it was progress without pattern. Messages more often than not failed to get through. Rates were raised and lowered without reason, without warning. And that was a bare 100 years ago.
I tell you, Hiram, it's a tremendous opportunity. You've just got to come in with us.
Build another telegraph line. Judge Selden, seems to me the country is overstocked with telegraph lines already. And they're all of them bad. Oh, Elizabeth.
Mrs. Sibley.
Oh, sit down, please. You go right ahead with your talk. I'll pour the coffee.
Well, Hiram, can I count you in?
I don't see it, Judge.
You don't?
No. It seems like a ridiculous venture, at least at this time. Right after Morse invented the telegraph, every Johnny and his cousin Mary began building telegraph lines. Result is that the country is suffering from a bad case of telegraphitis.
But, Hiram, the country's growing and the telegraph will grow with it.
Maybe, maybe so. Maybe when the men who run the telegraph industry begin to get some idea what the public expects, what it wants, maybe then it will amount to something.
Well, I must say I'm disappointed in your reaction, Hiram.
That's the way I feel about it, Judge. As things stand now, I want no part of the telegraph.
Well, then I suppose there's no use taking up more of your time. I'll be getting on.
Oh, but you will stay and have some coffee.
Sorry, afraid not, Mrs. Sibley. It's late. It's past my bedtime.
No hard feelings, Judge.
Oh, of course not. Won't change your mind, Hiram?
No.
Well, good night.
Good night, Judge.
Good night.
That surprises me. The judge is usually so sound in his business judgment, but this wild scheme, telegram, I don't see it. I think I'll sit and read in the parlor for a bit, Elizabeth. Have you seen that book I was reading?
The Federalist Papers?
Uh-huh.
Oh, I put it on your desk in the study. Is it an interesting book?
Very interesting. The arguments of Hamilton, Madison, and some of the other great statesmen of the time for the need of a strong national government. You wouldn't think they had to fight for the Constitution, argue for it, but they had to. They had to show that the country would never get anywhere as long as the states kept apart, each rivaling the other. They showed that the only way the country could survive was with a strong central authority.
Hmm. Seems to me, Hiram, that that's just what the telegraph companies need.
Hmm?
Well, isn't that right?
You mean some central authority?
Well, something to bring them together so they can serve the people efficiently. So they can give the country what it needs, though. Responsible, dependable, cheap way of sending messages across the country.
Yes.
Well, I'm going up to bed. Good night, dear.
Good night.
Wire to the West, Raymond Massey, a portion of Cavalcade of America. Our guest is the well-known playwright Robert Anderson. And we'll continue our conversation right after this message from our sponsor.
growing. You can count the difference when you're growing.
Cromwell Savings Bank of Cromwell.
The person who saves regularly guarantees his own bright future. Cromwell Savings Bank offers 6 convenient savings plans for their customers, including a 6-year certificate of deposit with a $1,000 minimum. These 6-year certificates of deposit pay an annual rate of 7.75% with an annual effective yield of 8.17%. Visit Cromwell Savings Bank and plan now for your future.
You grow more with us.
Cromwell Savings Bank of Cromwell.
Cromwell Savings Bank, member FDIC, where all deposits are insured up to $40,000.
Bob, let's get back to Theater Guild on the Air. First of all, you were mentioning earlier about Deborah Carr. You didn't meet your wife, Teresa Wright, by any chance through the Theater Guild on the Air, did you?
No, she did a show that I wrote, strangely enough, and we often commented later that we just didn't happen to meet on that show. I'm sure we met, Dick. I mean, it wasn't a question of not meeting because I sat in on all the rehearsals, and I was sitting right there in front of them. But she had a way, as I remember now, of darting out after each rehearsal. Mm-hmm. She didn't linger around, and she didn't go to lunch with the cast, which most of them did. She had a friend or somebody or other that I remember she was always away. But we did meet. She did Trilby with Rex Harrison, the old Svengali story.
And that's how you met?
No, we didn't.
Oh.
No, I said I didn't happen to meet him.
How did you actually meet him? Might as well hear the whole story now. We've got
right.
it out of the
would
bag.
Would you really like to know?
Yeah,
I really would love to know.
I want to tell you, you wouldn't believe it. And I would never dare write the story. Get ready to weep. Okay. My first wife was dying of cancer, and a very dear friend of mine by the name of Martin Manulis and his wife, Ed, you remember Martin Manulis,
yeah,
was
Playhouse
producer
90.
Of Playhouse 90, and his wife understudied Deborah Carr, Empty and Sympathy. And Mrs. Manulis was pregnant, and she came to my wife's bedside, I'd say the last month or so, and she said, Phyllis, I'd like you to be the godmother of my baby, which I'm expecting. And Phyllis said, I have 14 godchildren, and she says, Bob has none. And I was standing at the head of the bed, and so Katie Bard Manulis naturally turned to me and said, well, will you be the godfather? She was stuck. She couldn't do anything about it. So I said, sure, I'd be delighted to. And my first wife died, and about a year later, I went to California to write a movie and also to attend the christening. And Teresa was the godmother. And that's how we met.
Oh, that's a great story. It's a story, as
yeah.
you said, that...
I wouldn't dare write it.
No, no one would believe it.
Believe it.
Well, nevertheless, let's get back to the idea of playwriting and the problems that are inherently there for the playwright in radio. Obviously, you have to work with sound effects and with the spoken word. We were trying to figure out how you'd ever do the ending of Tea and Sympathy on the air. You can't do it. There's no way.
Well, yes,
you can't be doing it on radio, you know, tonight, maybe, Nick, if you know what I mean.
I would, Ed and I were talking about it before, and the end of Tea and Sympathy, for those who don't know, is where Deborah Carr, the character Laura, unbuttons the top 2 buttons of her blouse, getting ready to go to bed with this boy. And so I jokingly said it would have to be a zipper. And you could hear the zipper go down. I had a lot of those problems. It's fascinating. It's like a, handyman job. You have friends who are handymen, and you present them with electrical problems, or you say, my icebox doesn't work, or my television set doesn't work, and they come in and putter around with it, and they find how to make it work. Well, along with that question that you asked earlier about how do you harness an enormous novel like David Copperfield, once you've decided on that, there are certain technical things you'd have to do. Now, for example, I did Come Back, Little Sheba, which is a Bill Inges play about a man, an alcoholic, who is now Alcoholics Anonymous, but he's being driven crazy by his wife, who is played by Shirley Booth. And so you have this thing of he's always reaching for the bottle, but he doesn't use it, doesn't pour it. So I had to try to figure out how could I possibly dramatize that moment when he poured it. And I finally, I was writing it around Christmas time, and somebody gave me one of those bottle pourers that you stick in the bottle, top of your bottle of whiskey, and every time you pour it, it plays Auld Lang Syne or something.
Oh.
And so we established that as a gift and so on and so forth, so that terrible moment came when he finally poured it, and that, you heard that, should old acquaintance be forgotten. And then a very important part of radio, the orchestra, the music, which was always played those glorious bridges which prepared you for the next scene, took up the old Lang Syne thing and built it into a weird, terrible moment, terrifying moment.
And there was essentially no dialogue around.
No, because the man was alone on stage.
Right.
And you heard him walk. You know, you heard him walk over. You heard him open the cupboard, and then you heard this should old acquaintance be forgot. And you know he was taking his first drink, and that he would then go after his wife with an axe and so on. So that there are a lot of those. I can't remember all of them. I remember that one specifically because it was one of the toughest, is to try to find what the audience would see in the theater, and we had to make them hear it in radio. And that's fun. It's more fun than the other thing, which is just basic work of trying to harness a story which is 600 pages into what was essentially about 54 minutes.
Well, many times there are characters in the book that never appear either the screen or the radio adaptation. How do you decide to eliminate a character out of the? You know, some people may like the character or feel that mm-hmm. it's missing from the action.
Well, that's usually only in terms of a novel. In terms of a play, you can usually keep all the characters. And sometimes in a movie, you'd have to eliminate. You'd be surprised, though. I studied the movie scripts when I was doing these adaptations, and it was the first time I really realized that there are usually only about three good parts in a movie.
Really? Don't tell that to the actors.
No, but it's true. There are only approximately three good parts. And so you concentrate on those three good parts. I mean, if it's a triangle story, that's obvious. One of the men may have another girl somewhere in the offing, but you find out when you break it down that you may only have two scenes just to establish her.
Mm-hmm.
And but a novel is difficult, like Dickens, where everybody has his favorite characters, but you're able to generally keep enough of each one. First of all, you get out of that spine, and you say, how many of these people do I need to tell the story? And then how many I can allow the luxury to bring in for color or for dressing up? That's why playwriting to me, and as you know, I've written a novel, to me, playwriting is the backbone of all writing, because if you can write a good play, you understand progression, and that's all you need in a novel, too.
You know, getting back to that technique that you were talking about just a couple of moments ago of pouring the bottle, took a great deal of ingenuity and observation on your part, but not all of radio writing was that good or that slick. And I don't mean slick in any derogatory sense.
Let's say effective.
Effective, right. That's maybe, a much better word. Very often, they would use verbiage to describe things that didn't need to be described.
Yeah.
I remember listening, I don't know if I ever shared this one with you, Ed, but I remember listening to a Dick Tracy program, and they were questioning a suspect, and he asked for a glass of water, and I remember the line, because as a kid, I laughed at it. One of the policemen, Pat Harrington or whatever his name, Pat Patton, said, I'll give him the glass of water. I'm standing next to the water cooler.
That's great. Yes.
And I said to myself, well, you know, that was absolutely unnecessary. I'll give him the glass of water would have been fine, yeah. You know.
Oh, this is what Helen Hayes used to call scad picking. There's a lovely phrase. I think the someplace line, somebody brought up a question like that. Somebody said, don't we need to know that the cop is standing next to the suspect? And Helen Hayes said, you're not scad picking, for heaven's sakes. Mm. Let the audience... reminds me of a great story. It has nothing to do with the radio, but it's a Zanuck story, where a couple of it's a story conference. They're talking about Zanuck says, now this is the way I think the story should go, that so-and-so, and he gets the gun, and he puts it under the pillow, and or something, I forgot about that. But end of the story, the story writer said, how did the gun get under the pillow, Mr. Zanuck? And Zanuck says, I put it there. anything. But you know, one of the interesting things I'm remembering about radio, there used to be a rule that you had to get them in the first 30 seconds. Or the idea was that the hand reached out and turned the knob.
Yeah.
And Homer Fickett, who was the great director on the Theater Guild and the Air Shows, I think he directed all of them.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a rule that somehow or other, in the first 30 seconds, you'd have to. And we very often do it by a narration. I love to use narrations. You know, and it would go something like, I never knew that it was going to end this way when I started. And suddenly you have them hooked. something like that.
That was a great technique that was developed in the 40s of more or less stream of consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And this way you eliminated the narrator as such. Mm-hmm. It was the actor. It was
yes.
Bogart or...
It was a first-person narration. Usually.
Right,
yes.
Right.
I know Roger Pryor was the... Wasn't he the narrator on our show? And he used to get very furious because instead of coming in and saying, and so Richard does so-and-so, I always had the narration while the actors. It seemed to be much better to be told from a point of view.
Sure.
Just as a novel, the easiest novel to write is the first-person novel. So the easiest, I think, radio show or radio drama is the first person. And it makes it much more intimate, and you can say what's going on in the person's mind, and he can break in. You can have bridges. You can have voiceovers. You know that old business of a voice fading into the background, but you're still here, and but right. The hero is saying, you know, whatever is going on in his mind. It's a very flexible medium. I find it very exciting.
Yeah. When you wrote a script for Theater Guild on the Air, were you in the audience when it was performed? Were you there?
No. Generally, I would be at home listening to it. I was exhausted by that time, and I would be at home listening to it with friends. And they did do it in the theater, though. And it was quite a gala evening. Everybody, the actors got dressed up in evening clothes, and there was an invited audience. It was live laughter.
Yeah.
Live laughter. And it was either there or it wasn't there. I mean, nobody held up a sign saying, laugh. And sometimes, as a matter of fact, if we had a comedy, we'd run over. I mean, we'd start to run over, and then the actors would have to hurry up their lines and to get through on time.
Yeah, they didn't count all that laughter. Norman Brockenshire was the announcer on that show, wasn't he?
Yes,
one of the
mellifluous.
We'll get back to our guest, Robert Anderson, in just a moment.
Get growing. You can count the difference when you're growing.
Cromwell Savings Bank of Cromwell.
Now the friendly folks at Cromwell Savings Bank are friendlier than ever. In their continuing effort to expand and improve their services, they recently completed a survey of their customer banking needs. The result? A majority indicated a desire for Saturday morning banking facilities. So now, Cromwell Savings Bank is open Saturdays from 9 a.m. to 12 noon for full banking services. Bank with them on Saturdays for your banking convenience.
You grow more with us.
Cromwell Savings Bank of Cromwell.
Cromwell Savings Bank, member FDIC, is open Monday through Wednesday, 9 to 3, Thursdays, 9 to 5, Fridays, 9 to 7:30 p.m., and now Saturday mornings, 9 to 12 noon.
Robert Anderson is our guest, well-known playwright, having written so many plays, the most famous of which, I guess, is Tea and Sympathy. And
I sang for my father.
I never sang for my father. Yeah. And, you know, there we were talking when we did my daytime radio show about that, Bob, and there was a situation where you as the playwright had the final word, and you were convinced that the closing scene built to a climax, mm-hmm. and others around you weren't so convinced.
Yeah, that was a very exciting time. It's the only time I've ever done that, incidentally, because generally my scripts are in fairly good shape when we go into rehearsal. You hear about these terrible stories of people in New Haven dying, rewriting in the Taft Hotel, and that the lampshades are made of old playwrights' skins, you know, and so on. I never had that experience, fortunately or unfortunately. Maybe there were some of my plays that could have been vastly improved had we done it. But then I never sank my father. I tell a story generally, as this morning, when somebody says, are these stories fiction or fact? And the first draft, or the draft that finally went into rehearsal, if I never sank my father, it was pretty much all factual in terms of my life with my father. As a middle-aged man, my father is a quite old man. But the play failed to build to a climax. And Hal Holbrook was playing it, and Lillian Gish, and my wife, Teresa, and the director, Alan Schneider. And they all kept saying, you know, it doesn't build. And I kept saying, but that's the way it was. That's the way it's going to be. Finally, they did a run-through for me about 2.5-3 weeks into rehearsal, just before we were going to open in Philadelphia. And I saw for myself that it didn't build, and I wondered what to do. So I went back. It was very near Christmas, and I went back to my study, and I turned out all the lights, as I said, and turned on that one light on the desk, and I said, okay, Dad, let's have that scene we never had. And knowing my father and knowing myself, I wrote a scene, which we might have had, of confrontation, where we tore each other to bits, and brought it back. They threw their arms around me and said, gee, that's the scene. And it's the scene that made the play.
Yeah.
And it's the scene that made the movie. But that's why, and the point I think I was making this morning was it's a truer scene than many of the real scenes. And so when people say to me, well, that's a made-up scene, I said, sure, it's a made-up scene, but it has more truth in it. Picasso had a great line. He said, lies that tell the truth. That's what art is. He described lies that tell the truth. And that scene was a lie in the sense that it never happened, but it was the truth in the sense that that's what might have happened or would have happened.
Did this live audience that we're talking about ever disrupt a play through through laughter at a point where they shouldn't laugh. Let's say you're doing a dramatic theater guild on the air, and something is amusing. Perhaps a sound effect becomes amusing. Mm-hmm. Did that ever destroy the mood for you?
I'm trying to think. You see, we have the beautiful thing in the theater where we play 3 weeks on the road or 4 weeks on the road or maybe even New York before we open. So that any of those strange things which we thought were very dramatic, which are really funny, we can weed out. I think we used to have an invited audience on the Theater Guild show in the afternoon for the dress rehearsal. So that if anything did, you know, sometimes something you never foresee crops up and makes an audience laugh. But I don't remember it as ever disturbing it, no.
Mm, but that could be.
It happens in the real theater all the time.
Yeah.
Oh, you either get too dramatic or where it gets too theatrical and the emotion is not underneath it, then an audience tends to laugh out of self-protection. Because if they're not emotionally with it, they get very upset at something.
It must really make the actors feel quite uncertain if the audience laughs at a very heavy dramatic scene.
Well, now, going back to Tea and Sympathy, going back to the theater now for a second, we had that at the last scene of Tea and Sympathy where Deborah Carr offers herself to this boy. And Deborah used to get very, very upset. And Kazan said, look, Deborah, we are talking about things here in this theater for 1,000 people, which most people don't talk about in their own homes. So they're going to laugh at you out of nervousness.
Mm-hmm.
And said, you simply mustn't mind it. They're going to titter, they're going to giggle. But you mustn't let it bother you, and she didn't. And pretty soon after the play had run a little while, people got to know what it was about, and they came in there with seriousness.
Yeah, that's very important. Any anecdotes that you can recall with people like Bogart or Gary Cooper?
It's not really an anecdote, but radio really weeded out actors. You see, there are many actors in the movies who are really not actors, and I think that Gary Cooper was one of them.
Mm-hmm.
He was a marvelous screen actor. Nobody can ever question that. But it's a totally different technique. And Gary Cooper played this most difficult part opposite Shirley Booth, who originated the part in Come Back, Love, Shiva. Sidney Blackmore played the Gary Cooper part, or Gary Cooper played the Sidney Blackmore part. Well, this was rough on him because he's coming up against a girl who had won a Tony for the part, and he felt very awkward and very uncomfortable. They have to sit there, stand there, and read lines. And you see, in the movies, you don't have to do that. I mean, you do two lines at a time. Or he could always say, my wife, who did 3 movies with Gary Cooper, Pride of the Yankees, and I've forgotten what the others are, but that was the most famous, said that there was very often a script consultant who worked along with the script writer and said, you know, Mr. Cooper would say that, Mr. Cooper wouldn't say this, or couldn't say this, or whatever. And this was a very complicated part in Come Back, Little Sheba, and it was just very, very rough for him. And he had to be helped, because you're on your own for 54 minutes. There's nobody, you can't say, we'll do that over again. There was no tape. Mm-hmm. This was live from the Velasco Theater, the theater on the air. And you couldn't make any mistakes. There's no way of fixing them once you'd made them. It was very exciting. It's like live television.
Did he get through it?
He got through it, but he required a great deal of extra rehearsing with the director.
Mm.
And it was just simply, it was not his medium. And I think that's about, we didn't have too many boo-boos or bad things.
I would think on a show like that, the theater would have to cave in for anything really to go wrong. They must have been very well rehearsed. How long would they be in rehearsal?
Well, we would rehearse Mondays. The show went on Sunday, and so we'd rehearse Tuesday to give Homer Fickett a rest. Rehearse Tuesday for a couple of run-throughs, a couple of readings, a couple of run-throughs to hear how the lines sounded, to hear we were in time, always with that stopwatch, you see, because that was vital. Then we'd have a conference, and I would go home and rewrite Tuesday night, and Wednesday, I think. Then another rehearsal Thursday, a full big rehearsal, like 6-7 hours. And then finally about the 4 hours rehearsal, 4 or 5 hours rehearsal before the year. It was a very, very neatly rehearsed show and extensively rehearsed. Yeah,
we've talked to other radio actors, and they feel the same way, that when you put a good radio actor against a good movie actor, they can run circles around them as far as the use of the voice on the air.
Except we have a phrase in the theater. When somebody comes in and auditions for us, we say, uh-oh, it's a radio actor, which means that they can catch a certain quality of the part, and they catch it immediately, and they give you something, but they may never be able to go more deeply.
And that still applies today?
Yeah. Well, of course, there's not so many radio actors. You might say it's a soap opera actor. But these people in soap operas, you know, are handed a script maybe a day or less than a day before they go on. And they have to memorize the part, which is difficult enough in itself, so they tend to give often a superficial performance. And sometimes an actor will impress you enormously in a reading in a theater, and then he never goes any further.
Yeah.
Because he just has that glibness, that certain glib.
Which is what was required in radio for the workaday actor.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, we've been building up to Theater Guild on the Air all night long on this program, and I think it's about time that we played an excerpt from one of those shows, and, of course, one of your works, Bob, especially. And we have a big treat, I think, in this recording of John Steinbeck's Of Mice and Men. Burgess Meredith is featured along with June Havoc, who was a star here on this program about 2 or 3 years ago. And so let's listen to Of Mice and Men, adapted for radio by Robert Anderson.
Ladies and gentlemen, the United States Steel Corporation invites you to hear Burgess Meredith and June Havoc in the Theater Guild on the Air production of Mice and Men. Every day, everywhere, you are served by products of steel. At home, in your business, and when you travel. The trademark of United States Steel, USS, on any steel product is your guide to quality steel. And now, here is Roger Pryor speaking for the Theater Guild, one of America's foremost theatrical producers.
And good evening, everyone. Our play tonight, Of Mice and Men, by John Steinbeck, was a best-selling novel, a popular motion picture, and as a play, it won the Drama Critics Award. Our stars tonight are Burgess Meredith, who recreates his motion picture role of George, and June Havoc, who plays Curly's wife. George Matthews, currently appearing in the Theater Guild stage success The Silver Whistle, is featured as Lenny, the big man with a child's mind, and John Hamilton plays his original stage role of Candy. We raise the curtain on Of Mice and Men, adapted for radio by Robert Anderson.
Guys like us that work on ranches is the loneliest guys in the world. They ain't got no family. They don't belong no place. They ain't. Now, what am I doing? Talking. Talking to myself just the way I always talk to Lenny. Maybe even when he was with me, I was talking to myself. How it was going to be different with us. How we was going to have a little house of our own and some land and those rabbits. Yeah, he always knew when I was talking about them rabbits, the dumb ox. Like that night sitting on the bench up in Weed.
Tell me, George. Tell me like you done before.
Tell you what, Lenny?
About the rabbits.
Look, Lenny, I not only got to look after you like you was a kid, I got to keep telling you the same story over and over again.
Go on, George. About the place and the rabbits.
Okay. Now, someday soon, we're going to save enough money to have a little place of our own. Wait a minute, Lenny. What do you got in your hand?
I ain't got nothing, George, honest.
Come on, you give that to me.
It's only a mouse.
A mouse?
Just a dead mouse.
Well, you killed it, didn't you, Lenny? Can't you get it through your thick head that you got hands like sledgehammers when you touch something? Here, give that to me.
I was just petting it while we were sitting here. It was nice and soft.
You give it to me.
Oh, don't throw it away, George. Don't throw it away.
Oh, gee. Stop blubbering. Oh, Lenny, I didn't throw it away just for meanness. You broke it, petting it with those hands of yours.
There was a lady who used to give mice to me.
Don't you even remember who that lady was?
No.
Well, you can't remember anything, can you, Lenny? That was your aunt, and she stopped giving them to you because you always killed them.
They were so little. I'd pet them, and pretty soon they'd bite my finger, and then I pinched them a little bit, and then they was dead because they were so little.
Well, Lenny, can't you ever realize the size of you? Look, hold out your hand next to mine. See that? It's twice as big as mine.
I wish we'd get the rabbits pretty soon, George. They ain't so little. Tell me, George. Tell me like you've done before.
All right, Lenny. Guys like us that work on ranches is the loneliest guys in the world. They ain't got no family. They don't belong no place. They come to a ranch, they get a little money together, then they go into town and blow it. And the next thing you know, they're working again in some other ranch. They ain't got nothing to look ahead to.
Now tell how it is with us, George.
You know, Lenny, I've been telling you this most every day now since we've been traveling and working together.
Tell it again, George.
Well, with us, Lenny, it ain't lonely, because...
Because I got you to look after me, and you got me to look after you.
That's right. And we're going to get us a job on a ranch here tomorrow, and then we're going to save our money, and we're going to get a little farm...
With rabbits.
Yeah, with rabbits.
We got a future.
Yeah, Lenny. If you can stay out of trouble on our next job, we got a future. Maybe I should have let him keep that mouth. If I had, he wouldn't have touched that dress. That red velvet-like dress on the girl who was standing next to us looking in the store window.
George, you going to buy something in this store?
No, I'm just looking.
George, look at the dress on this girl.
What of it?
It's pretty. Looks soft.
Yeah, well, forget about it and come over here. I want to look in this window.
Soft dress.
Hey, you, let go my sleeve.
It's soft.
Lenny!
Let go my sleeve. Let go! Help!
Hey, Lenny, let go! Let go of it! Let go, you hear?
George, you hit me. I didn't mean nothing wrong.
What's the matter?
Now, run, Lenny. They'll be after you in a minute. Come on, Lenny, run!
Come on, Lenny. Jump down in the ditch.
Keep down.
I guess we shook them off.
Hey, George, I didn't mean anything wrong, George.
Yeah, all the time it's something you don't mean. Why did you touch her dress?
It was soft.
Well, if they ever found you, they'd lynch her, they'd shoot you. Now, how'd you like that?
George, you wouldn't let them, would you?
What could I do about it? You're nothing but trouble, Lenny. A big ox like you, and you're nothing but trouble. I don't know why I stick with you. If I was alone, I could... Oh, forget it. Well, we'll get a ride south tomorrow and see if we can't get us a job on a ranch in Lower California.
George.
What do you want?
I'm sorry.
Why didn't we get fired? Why didn't the boss fire us that night? I never should have let Slim talk him out of it. Then Lenny wouldn't have been out in the barn the next morning with his puppy, and none of it would have happened.
Poor little puppy. Why did you gotta get killed, puppy? You ain't so little as mice. I didn't bounce you hard. Gotta hide you in the straw here. Yeah. Now, let's see. This ain't no bad thing like I gotta go hide in the brush for. What's that? Who's that?
Huh? Who's that? Oh, it's only you. What are you doing here in the barn?
Just sitting here.
Listen, you won't tell nobody you saw me here with my suitcase, will you?
George told me I ain't to talk to you or nothing.
You're nuts, ain't you? But you're a kind of nice fella anyway. It is like a big baby. A person can kind of see what you mean, though. You know, when I'm doing my hair sometimes, I just sit there and I stroke it because it's so soft. Like this. Some people got kind of coarse hair. Not mine. Mine is soft and fine. Here, would you like to touch you right here in the back of my neck?
Well, I don't...
Aw, oh, don't be so scared all the time. Come on, give me your hand. Boy, that's something Mitch you got there. There, put on my head. Right in the back of my head. You see what I mean there? My hair is soft and silky, ain't it? That's nice, ain't it?
Yeah.
Go on now. Don't mess my hair up.
Bro. That's nice. That's nice.
Hey, look out there. That's too hard. See, go on now. You're going to mess it up. Ow! Ow! Hey, look, you stop it now. You're going to mess it all up. Hey, let go. Hey, let go.
Oh, please don't do that. George will be mad. I can't let you go if you're going to make noise. George will hear you and he'll be mad. If I take my hand away, you won't scream, will you? Now, go. I don't want you to yell. You're going to get me in trouble just like George says you will. If you go on yelling, I'll shake you. I'll shake you like this, see? I don't want to hurt you. But George will be mad if you yell.
An excerpt from Of Mice and Men. It's adapted for radio by our guest tonight here on the Golden Age of Radio, the well-known playwright Robert Anderson. We'll get back to our guest right after this message.
Get growing, you can count the difference when you're growing.
Cromwell Savings Bank of Cromwell.
With the ever-increasing cost of living, it's harder to save these days. Yet it's more important than ever to make that extra sacrifice to save. Why? Well, because tomorrow's dreams will still be financed with today's savings. Cromwell Savings Bank suggests that, whatever the amount, you save on a regular weekly basis. It's a good habit that you'll be thankful you acquired. Visit Cromwell Savings and inquire about any one of their six convenient savings plans.
You grow more with us.
Cromwell Savings Bank of Cromwell.
Cromwell Savings Bank, member FDIC, where you can now save Saturday mornings from 9 to 12 noon. Plenty of free parking available.
Bob, there are so many facets to your career that we haven't even touched, but this is the golden age of radio, and we did want to concentrate on that tonight, and I found it fascinating talking with you and learning about how you developed your craft through this marvelous medium of radio. It's been very enjoyable.
Thank you, Dick. I've always loved radio, and it's been fun to talk about it.
Robert Anderson, our guest tonight here on the Golden Age of Radio. And until next time, this is Dick Bertel.
Ed Corcoran.
Good night.
The Golden Age of Radio has been brought to you by WTIC and Cromwell Savings Bank, located at Main and West Streets in Cromwell, a friendly bank in a friendly town. The Golden Age of Radio was produced by Bill Grasty and Dick Bertel.
Presents the Charlie McCarthy Show. Gentlemen, greeting you from Hollywood, California. On behalf of Edgar Bergen, Charlie McCarthy, Mortimer Stern.